From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. Given the importance of the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as the changing landscape around the evaluation and management of these patients, I've again chosen articles this week related to COVID. I'm going to review briefly an article talking about diagnostic testing, quite a nice review from the Annals of Internal Medicine, an article in Circulation which asks the question, how should we consider management of ST elevation MI in the COVID-19 era, and then some more granularity around how COVID-19 and the renin-angiotensin blockers relate to each other and how we should consider this paradigm in terms of treatment. So let's start with a really excellent review by Chang and colleagues in the Annals of Internal Medicine about diagnostic testing for COVID-19. Given the lack of effective vaccine or treatment right now, the only strategy we have to slow the pandemic is through identifying and isolating contagious persons and then a massive deployment of testing. And as you know, diagnostic testing capacity in the U.S. has been limited at the beginning of the outbreak, partly due to regulatory hurdles and possibly to a problem with some contamination in the beginning. Serum and urine are negative for the presence of viral nucleic acid, regardless of the illness severity. So serologic tests are available to look for antibodies to the COVID-19 virus, but they have limited utility because the antibody response to infection can take days to weeks in order to be detectable. And there are cross-reactive assays with other coronavirus proteins. So testing for the purpose of assessing immunity is still being explored. The CDC diagnostic strategy relies on collection of respiratory tract samples to assess for the presence of nucleic acid targets specific to COVID-19. A nasopharyngeal flock swab is preferred, and antigen detection is the goal, but there may be suboptimal sensitivity depending on the degree of sample acquisition. So currently, as you know, the CDC has been recommending that three groups of people be tested: hospitalized individuals suspected of having COVID-19, patients at high risk of poor outcomes such as in nursing homes, and persons who've had close contact with somebody suspected or confirmed to have COVID-19. And currently, testing of asymptomatic persons has not been recommended, but this, I think, largely has been the problem of availability of widespread testing. It's important to note that concomitant infections with COVID-19 have been reported in up to 60% of patients. Thus, COVID-19 cannot be ruled out as the only cause of a respiratory pathogen, and some patients will have had a prior pathogen as well as COVID-19. Also, just like influenza, sometimes patients with COVID-19 will have a bacterial infection move in behind the viral infection, and this has to be suspected, particularly in patients who are critically ill or those who take a turn for the worse after initial stabilization. At least two negative upper respiratory tract samples collected at 24-hour intervals are currently recommended to document that the COVID-19 virus has been cleared. Chest imaging is pretty sensitive, 78 to 100% in the diagnosis of COVID-19, but of course it lacks specificity as other things can cause the same findings. And of course, elevations in inflammatory biomarkers, et cetera, clearly happen in patients with advanced illness, but their exact role in terms of triage and treatment is yet to be determined. So I thought this was an excellent article about the current challenges with diagnostic testing. Obviously, this is moving rapidly, and we need to have more testing, but we'll have to wrestle with the fact that the diagnostic accuracy of the various types of tests, whether it be for the antigen or the antibody, is going to be somewhat variable. The second article I wanted to talk about was a nice reflection on COVID-19 and STEMI offered by Dr. Daniels and colleagues in Circulation this week. And they posed the question, you know, what should we do with STEMI in the current COVID-19 pandemic? And they asked the very appropriate question, and that is if fibrinolytic first approach should be considered as primary treatment over PCI. You may remember I covered this topic just in the last 2 weeks from a hospital in China, which recommended that for STEMI, we certainly consider primary fibrinolysis first over PCI. Currently in U.S. practice, about 13% of STEMIs receive pharmacoinvasive therapy, which is sort of a drip and ship. They get a thrombolytic agent, then often get shipped to a transfer center for PCI and PCI at 6 to 24 hours. The authors of this review make a case for considering fibrinolytic therapy as primary therapy during the COVID-19 pandemic for STEMI patients who present early within 3 hours of symptoms and don't have any high-risk clinical findings for fibrinolysis. Obviously, patients presenting later, presumably the clot has been more stabilized and the likelihood that fibrinolytic therapy would be effective is lower. Clearly, the use of this strategy could mitigate delays in reperfusion related to increased time in the ER. And of course, that's related to COVID testing, the kind of contact precautions that need to be taken, et cetera. And so door to needle time may be quicker when primary PCI capabilities exist at the hospital if they have diagnostic testing and the rapid turnaround. So fibrinolytic therapy is advantageous from the standpoint of resource utilization, protection of essential healthcare workers, and patients could be considered for PCI if COVID-19 has been ruled out. The authors offer an algorithm and suggest that emergent PCI would be reserved for patients who are at high risk or those who fail reperfusion. And clearly, we want to think about the capabilities of our cath labs, our staff, and the challenges of getting patients from the ER to the cath lab as we ponder this decision. I like this review because I think it's thoughtful. It certainly suggests that fibrinolytic therapy is a very reasonable thing to do in the COVID-19 era in patients who are early presenters, who don't have high-risk features for lytic treatment, and for whom there is no other high-risk factor that would suggest that PCI is preferred. The last article I want to talk about this morning came out this week in Circulation by Dr. Meserly and colleagues, and it's sort of a further dive into the evidence around renin-angiotensin blockers in COVID-19. I'm getting a lot of questions from my patients in my practice, and I'm sure you are, and so I thought this article actually digs a little deeper into the interrelationship between COVID-19 and the RAS system. So, as you know, both angiotensin II converting enzyme inhibitors and angiotensin II receptor blockers have been suggested to possibly slow progression of pulmonary complications in vulnerable patients. So these seemingly beneficial findings of the RAS blockade on outcomes have been raised again in the current era of COVID-19 infection. Also, epidemiologic data suggests that patients with cardiovascular disease and or hypertension are more susceptible to COVID-19 infection, and that the course of pneumonia may be more severe in these individuals. The recently identified strain of COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2, relies on the ACE2 protein as a cellular entry receptor, and this is similar to the SARS-CoV virus. And it's interesting to know that ACE2 expression protects from lung injury, and that action is downregulated by the binding of the SARS-CoV-19 to the receptor protein. In experimental models and in humans, RAS blockade has been shown to upregulate ACE2 activity, thereby potentially antagonizing some of the effects of COVID-19. But there are no clinical data currently available suggesting a favorable effect of RAS blockade on pulmonary outcomes in patients infected with the SARS-CoV-2 virus. There has been speculation that perhaps enhanced A2 expression with RAS antagonists might increase the number of binding sites, and that might increase the odds of infection with SARS-CoV-2. One interesting feature from this review is that the renin-angiotensin system effects among the available blockers is different. Direct renin inhibitors have been shown to diminish activity of the RAS system and downregulate ACE2 receptors in animal models. Thus, the renin-angiotensin blockade and cardiopulmonary protection appears to be maintained. So, what does this all mean? Well, there are theoretical reasons why ACEs or ARBs could increase risk with COVID-19 access to the lungs, and there are theoretical reasons from appropriate models that they might reduce risk. And so where were we at? The guidelines currently recommend that we continue ACEs and ARBs in patients diagnosed with COVID-19 infection. And in non-infected patients and patients at risk, there's no valid reason to discontinue RAS blockade. In healthy subjects at risk, there's no sufficient evidence yet to prophylactically recommend RAS blockade. And if there's apprehension in a patient who's infected, patients could be switched from an ACE or an ARB to a direct renin inhibitor, but again, this is not proven. In COVID-19 positive patients on RAS blockers, we think the drug should be continued. In febrile patients with pulmonary symptoms on RAS blockade, close monitoring of blood pressure and renal function is advisable, and obviously these agents should be discontinued if clinically indicated. So I've covered three articles that came out just in the past few days related to COVID. We talked about diagnostic testing, we talked about the strategy for reperfusion of STEMI, and we talked about a deep dive into COVID-19 and the renin-angiotensin blockers. I want you to take note that on acc.org, we have a wonderful hub that's available to you. The COVID-19 hub includes clinical guidance and practice, clinical perspectives and frontline experience, regulatory reimbursement updates, on CVD management and on-demand webinars. So I recommend those to you. Clearly, this is a rapidly moving area of science, and our goal at ACC is to continue to bring you articles that we think will enrich your knowledge and hopefully improve your care of these patients. I want to thank you for listening to Eagle's Eye View. This has been your weekly ACC.org update. I recorded this conversation on April 20th, and I hope you'll stay safe and look forward to talking to you again soon. Thank you.